everyone, to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 189. We're all back in our respective homes, wherever they may be. It's weird. It's like we're getting back to normal, and yet this feels in some ways less normal than what we were doing last weekend. I've got all these programs running and shit now. And I'm not going to talk much about PAX now. We're going to get into that after the break. Not for too long, but just a final wrap-up and talk about a few things, hear from Greg, his thoughts on how everything went. But I do want to say up front that all of our podcast coverage from PAX has now been uploaded. There were 4 episodes in all, including the bonus episode of us playing Magic the Gathering, which is only... I didn't make an article for that. I figure that's kind of inside baseball. That's like for people who listen to the show really regularly, and even then you might not like it. So it's on the feed. If you're subscribed, you should have it. If you are not subscribed, you can subscribe if you want it, basically. It's nothing amazing or anything like that, but you know, it's out there for those who are interested. I'm sure it's entertaining to some people. So anyway, there were 4 in all, and we did post them kind of one day after another. So if you don't check iTunes every day, you might have actually missed one. iTunes has a habit of only downloading the most recent one that it sees. So if you didn't get all 4 podcasts from PAX and you want to, make sure you go in iTunes and open up the list and actually manually download any of them that are grayed out, because I know I have to do that all the time when shows put up too many episodes simultaneously or back to back. So I just wanted to throw that out there for iTunes users. Now we're on to new business, and we're going to start off by hearing from someone we did not hear from last weekend. That's Greg Lay.
Yeah, well, I enjoyed my week off from editing. I got to do lots of things I don't normally get to do. I did go back to New Super Mario Bros. Wii a little bit, actually, to see some of those secret levels that I hadn't got to before. And that was actually really quite a lot of fun. I've been enjoying some of those. It was definitely, you know, you see some things you really haven't seen in any of the other levels. Quite.
Did you have fun getting all the coins?
I didn't have so much fun unlocking these levels, and I wouldn't even say so much as the coins, but in terms of the secret goals that you find, for instance, in some cases is the same as finding a coin, because it'll be just before the secret goal or something. But when you find it, secret levels in the regular maps rather than the World 9, I think they're just too leveraged on false walls and, you know, like invisible blocks and all this kind of stuff. You end up sort of rubbing along every wall in the game, because it's like, I mean, there's some that are like kind of suspicious looking and you can kind of tell, but there are others that are a lot more kind of subtle, and at some point it kind of gets bogged down. I prefer the way Mario World did it, I think, was oftentimes, I mean, there's some of that, don't get me wrong, but oftentimes a little more interesting. Like, there's a lot more stuff involving kind of like puzzles with P switches and the keys and the locks stuff and all that. You know, it's a bit more transparent, but also more tricky, rather than just kind of being really thorough about everything. But in terms of the levels themselves, there's some really cool stuff in the secret levels. Like there was one like where you kind of on this like bone dragon roller coaster through lava.
Oh yeah, 2IP showed that one to me.
Yeah, I hadn't had the time to go back to it, I guess, you know, especially with the way we do the show and everything. You always want to talk about something new, so it was a bit of a luxury that I had of more time to do it, but I'm really glad that I did. But the main thing that I'm going to talk about here is Silent Hill Shattered Memories, which I played through. I think I finished playing through it just after the last time that we recorded together. So I'm going back a little bit now, but obviously not the longest game. It was quite brief to play through, but I enjoyed it. It's an intriguing little game. It's difficult to sort of rank it with other game experiences, because at least the ones that I've had, it's really quite different from them. I mean, it's so kind of leveraged on atmosphere and storytelling and stuff. I thought it was generally pretty effective. Certainly that I was impressed by the facial acting that you had with the psychiatrist in particular. The exploration kind of stuff was, you know, pretty good, because the world was quite meticulously designed. There's all this stuff to look at and everything. But the adventure kind of aspect, the puzzle solving and all, I just felt that it wasn't quite all the way there. It didn't feel like, considering that you have this sort of very strict partition between those bits of the chase scenes and you haven't got any combat, it felt like it needed to be a little bit more developed, perhaps. It was generally pretty simple stuff, you know, you're using the phone a lot and sort of just looking for little clues and things. But I guess one thing I would say about it in terms of as a pacing issue is that you don't ever feel like it gets too bogged down and it keeps the kind of momentum of the story going, which is important because that is the focus of it. But I just kind of felt like maybe there could have been a bit more development in the gameplay. I mean, I guess the biggest developments are probably in the nightmare sequences, which just get more increasingly bizarre and frustrating, which is deliberate.
Right, yeah. They do get more and more frustrating as you go, don't they?
Yeah, which is entirely deliberate. I mean, the imagery and everything about it, just the kind of, they become increasingly nonsensical, essentially, to navigate and to do anything in. Which, as I say, is the point. But I think had there been some sort of parallel gameplay development alongside that, then I think that probably would have gone down rather more well than it did. But I still enjoyed it. I still thought it was a really unique, engaging experience. Certainly looks very nice on Wii. And again, I thought they did... it's one of these things where, like, you know, when you've got all this surreal stuff and... you know there's going to be some sort of a twist ending kind of thing going on. You know, there's going to be some sort of sting in the tail. And obviously I won't say what it is because it's so important to the game, really. But I was of the mind, like, well, I know what's coming, so it better be good. And I thought it actually was quite good. Yeah. So I guess that was the main delivery on that. And there was a few, like, hearkenings to things. In particular, I hate to seem like I always bring things back to David Lynch, but there's a part in the in the high school sort of reunion phase where just got the lady singing that weird version of You Were Always On My Mind.
Oh, yeah. That's very Mulholland Drive.
Mulholland Drive. And subverting a sort of popular oldie, like Roy Orbison's Crying in the case of Mulholland Drive, with this sort of spooky, kind of is sort of just off kilter, taking something familiar, doing something weird with it, just kind of makes it feel wrong in your mind. You know what I mean?
I know people who actually can't hear Crying Now, the Roy Orbison song, because it reminds them of that scene in Mulholland Drive, and it disturbs them so much.
Yeah, exactly. I think it certainly that kind of thing will change how you perceive something for a long time. So it doesn't surprise me that they would kind of draw from that particular scene. But, I mean, I think it does do a lot of things really quite well. I think it's quite a narrative kind of accomplishment now. I ended up getting it for a very, very reasonable price, which was, you know, very much commensurate with how long it lasted. It's difficult to say how I would have felt about it if I would been in a different position of paying full price for it. But I know Andy liked it a lot, a review.
Yeah. He probably didn't pay for it either, though, right?
Well, of course.
Well, that doesn't make a big difference.
He had a review copy.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty much his Wii game of the year.
It might be mine, too. And actually, Greg, I wanted to ask you, do you think it should have been longer?
I wouldn't necessarily say so. I mean, it's one of these things where, as I said, I think the pacing felt good. And I don't know how much longer... you know, whether the story would have been better served by putting more material in it. You know, I think there's, as I said, when you've got this feeling of inevitability of the quote-unquote rug puller, I don't think you can really sustain that for all that long without it getting kind of tedious. So I wouldn't advocate that it's longer, but there's still the kind of bang for your buck question that goes into it.
Yeah, there totally is. No, I agree with you. I mean, I think some of the mechanics of the gameplay could have been done a little better, and I hope, you know, they get to do some kind of sequel to this, because I think there's tons of potential.
I agree.
But in terms of the storytelling and the atmosphere and the pacing, I'm with you. I think they work extremely well, and I wouldn't have changed much about that. And I actually really like the fact that, not the combat, but the part where you can actually die is separated from the exploration. Because it gives the exploration a completely different feeling, because you're looking around, and when you find something that's kind of out of place and scary, and you start to hear weird sounds, you know they can't hurt you, but I think because of that, the developers are actually able to make it way more creepy and disturbing than if you were... you know, because it basically takes you out of your survival instinct, and it actually just lets you kind of soak in the weirdness of what's going down.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
If that makes any sense.
It's just the level that the game works on. It's more just this kind of, you know, the psychological level rather than the kind of, you know, flight level.
Yeah.
Although certainly, I mean, the chase sequences, yeah, I mean, they can be quite intense and stuff. But I guess one thing I will say about the chase sequences, I did like the little puzzles that you get in the middle. Like, you, usually there'd be one room where everything kind of stops, and then you've got a puzzle where, say, for instance, you have to, like, listen to one of the messages you get on your phone and, like, deduce, like, a musical sequence or something like that. They were probably some of the better puzzles in the game, and they were actually sandwiched in the nightmare bits.
Okay, well, anything else before we move on?
No, I imagine next week I'll probably speak about Pokemon, because I've been playing that quite a lot, but it's a very extensive experience, Pokemon Soul Silver, so I'll probably reserve comment until later, although, as is often the case with these sorts of things, there isn't a great deal to report, but it is still fun.
So, speaking of Pokemon, James, have you launched into the new ones yet?
Not yet.
Or old ones?
I am at about 6 feet underwater in terms of games at the moment.
Oh, okay. Well, tell us about them.
I'll start with games that I'm currently buried under. Right now, I bought Retro Game Challenge for the flight.
Fuck yes.
I haven't gotten that
good work.
Haven't gotten that far into it yet. Maybe like 3 or 4 games in. Because the flight, actually, I was flying perpendicular to the sun both times the whole way. which with the DS, especially the old one, essentially makes it.
Oh yeah, you've got a disgrace.
DS fat.
Yeah. Well, I do have the DS gigantic gray thing, except I actually upgraded to the DS even more gigantic large thing with our review copy of the XL.
So, what do you think? What do you think of that?
Well, the screen is... Everybody talks about, oh, the screen's huge. No, it really is gigantic. It's it's mind-blowing how big that screen is. You're just like, why? Why is it this big? I think part of the review, I'm going to have to play EBA on it, and I'm pretty sure EBA will become impossible.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see how it affects games like that, where you're using the touchscreen very, very fast.
Yeah, it might be impossible to play that game, because it's just so damn big. But it is heavier than the original DS by a little bit. It's actually larger by a substantial amount. But, you know, it's the DSi functionality is nice. You know, it's got that new operating system that you can run out of. I've run into a foible of the hardware, though, where the power button, I don't know if it's like this on the DSi, but it is kind of soft. It's not just the hard plastic button you had on the original DS where you just click it.
Yeah, I think it's in the same place on the XL.
Yeah, so when I was playing it earlier today, I was going to turn it off, and I held down the button, and nothing happened. Because it's soft, there's no click. And nothing happened, and nothing happened, and nothing. And it just wouldn't turn off. And eventually, I had to pull the game out, so that froze it. I closed it, and eventually, it turned off on its own.
Weird.
But it's the button, because the button doesn't really go down when you turn it off. It just kind of, you just kind of push on it and hope it turns off on its own. So I kind of wish they kept some click in that button. I mean, you know, whatever. And the volume up and down thing's kind of weird, because you can't tell if you're all the way to max volume or not. Basically, you have to go until it stops.
Oh, because it's got, like, software-based...
Yeah, it's not. I think the micro's got that sort of thing in it, where, rather than the slider.
Well, does the DSi. It's just the click, right?
Yeah. Besides that, I mean, yeah, it's great. I know I made fun of the big, giant pen, but actually it's really comfortable for extended play sessions, much more so than a stylus.
Much more so than that original
DS. Oh, God, yeah, that stylus.
So it was like a toothpick.
Yeah, it's so small, and my hand cramps so much playing that after, you know, an hour, 2 hours. But again, you aren't meant to play the DS for 4 hours straight.
Well, the XL, you could. Certainly.
You could, yeah, except you're...
I've played DS for 4 or 5 hours.
Oh, yeah, I did all the
time,
but you know, I don't think it was designed for that in mind. But you actually can't play the XL for 4 or 5 hours straight because your arms will fall off. But if you set it down on a surface, you'll be okay.
Put it down like a laptop.
Yeah. It actually is markedly close to the size of my netbook, which we'll have a picture of in the review. It's actually surprising how close they are in size. I've gotten to the DSi shop channel with my DSi points I got somewhere. Thinking I'm going to have to go with some birds and beans because Zach spoke highly of it.
Yeah, you can review the other half of it.
So getting on to games, I sent out an email to the staff. I'm not sure if you all got it, but EA was running a PAX promotion, which is kind of funny because they didn't have much presence at PAX.
They had APB.
That's it. Basically, they had APB and they had Dante's Inferno.
Yeah.
But you could get $20 off your order. So I ordered Dragon Age Origins Awakening, even though I said I wouldn't get it because it's not worth $40. But I got it. I got it for $19, so it was definitely worth that. just kind of started that, kind of looking at it. It's kind of set aside at the moment, so I can actually get into completing Infinite Suffering.
Oh, gosh.
Which I haven't...
Do you have anything new to report on Infinite Space? I feel like we've heard so much grumbling about it.
Well, I've never actually really given the game a thorough description on how it plays. Just...
Yeah, well, because you'd only played it very briefly the last time we recorded. Your further commentary on it was part of the rambling drunk cast, which...
Yeah. It wasn't really the right format to discuss the intricacies of this game.
No.
I can't imagine it was.
So... I like the game, just to be clear. I really, really like this game.
I always love the way that is a caveat that James has to issue.
Well, no. If this game weren't so goddamn hard, it would be very hard to imagine any game's going to take it out for my DS Game of the Year. But,
wow,
it is that hard. It is it is such a brutally hard game that it is mind-blowing.
Is there not any kind of difficulty setting?
Oh, God, no. No.
I think that's why it's been so divisive as well.
Yeah,
the reviews.
It's not just hard. It's unfairly hard. I mean, it does things that are unfair.
So it's cheap.
Yeah, and you just think, how in the hell was I supposed to survive that? And you weren't. The game didn't want you to do that. And here's a great example. When you go... The idea is that your character... To give you the basics of the story, was born on a planet in a galaxy where there's essentially feudalism takes place, and you know, individual planets are ruled by local lords, and then in some cases there's collections of planets that have formed nations. And he's born in some backwater planet that has its own local lord, and this guy, in an attempt to maintain his control over this region, has basically said no one is allowed to leave the planet, no space travel for anybody on my planet, and basically. He hires someone to get him off the planet so he can pursue his dream of going into space.
A wolf.
Basically. He's a rogue. And as you go out, he starts to become embroiled in local affairs, basically because he wants to go on an adventure and he finds plenty of adventure for himself. And what happens is you fight enemies in one of two ways. One is ship-to-ship combat and one is on foot in this sort of rock-paper-scissors game. Ship-to-ship combat is pretty much the main thrust of the combat. You have a gauge that fills up based on stats you can manipulate with your ships and your crew. That when it's got three layers, green, yellow, red, and when it's yellow, you can do certain moves, and when it's red, you can do others. And basically, it's all a strategy of determining when to use what moves and then how to respond to their moves before they do them. And that's fine. There's a lot of strategy to be had there, but it's just really hard sometimes. So you'll fight a boss, and then before you can save, as you start to move to the next planet to save, you're attacked. It's like, well, gee, I'm in no shape to fight anyone, and I've been attacked. Thanks, game.
So you can't save anywhere?
No, you cannot. You have to save on a planet surface.
That's always a problem with handheld games.
Yeah.
Even in stuff like Mario and Luigi, I get pissed off at that they want me to go to a certain place to save.
Now, the thing is, to get from planet to planet is literally maybe 5 seconds at most. Now, what could happen, though, is you get attacked during that path. And most fights you can escape from, some you can't, but the vast majority you can escape from. And in the case I was referencing, you could not escape from it, which was wonderful. But one of the ways this game sort of tells its story is you go from planet to planet and you kind of explore the surface of the planet by going to places like taverns and special locations on different planets and talking to people there and adding members to your crew and, you know, experiencing the story. And it's a good story. I've kind of enjoyed where the story's gone with it. And it just feels like sometimes the game likes to kick you in the ass, and you have to kind of force your way through it. And during PAX, I was really pissed at it. And this was the point where I was like, I'm not going to play this game anymore. Because there was a boss who could kill you, essentially, with 3 shots. Well, he wouldn't go down until you probably put 20 in him. And what I realized was I had built this big fleet that I thought was super impressive. It was dominating everything. And its strategy was, I have a ton of firepower, and I can kill you at long range, and I'm going to win everything. Well... His strategy, his ship, single ship, was built to do the exact same fucking thing, but way better than mine. So I couldn't beat him like I had to beat him. So I lost to him probably 30 times. Before finally I said, all your weapons have a range, so there's a maximum range and a minimum range. So in some cases the minimum range is 0, so if you're touching the other person's ship you can hit them. And I realized all his guns are exactly like mine. So if I get right next to him, I can win this. And that didn't work because he had more health than me. So I brought in a bunch of... So basically, I went back to my fleet and brought out these old missile ships that I used from really early in the game that are really, really weak and get blown up easily. Stuck them behind my capital ship, which meant if my one ship in front got blown up, I lost. And basically got right up in his face and killed him very, very slowly with that strategy. And I felt so smart after doing that because, oh my god, there's actually strategy in this game that I hadn't thought of.
not just brute force.
Yeah, like I had to rearrange my fleet and fight a completely different battle strategy than I've been fighting to beat him. And once I did that, I won, first try. The problem was there was nothing in the game to tell me, hey, why don't you try this?
Yeah.
I had to figure that
trial and error.
I had to figure that shit out.
30 trials.
And I actually only figured it out partially by accident. And
you'll be set up perfectly for Monster Hunter, James.
Oh, yeah.
So it sounds really complicated, but I do think you've given me a much better idea of what the game is all about.
Yeah, it's long, too. It is so long.
Well, it's infinite.
Yeah, it feels that way. Like,
and there's a lot of space in it, too.
There is a ton of space in it. Like, I thought, like, maybe I'm getting close. No.
Wait a minute. There's more space here.
Damn it. So actually, I have a question, James. Infinite Space, made by Platinum Games.
Yes.
I don't know how many other Platinum Games titles you've played, but if you have, I was wondering if you see any kind of thread of quality or design or anything that it has in common.
I've always felt like Platinum Games have a certain amount of just, this is really cool. This is a really good idea. Mm-hmm. There's a certain amount of novelty in them, but there's always something wrong with them. Like some element that's just not right.
Yeah, like they lack depth or something like that.
Yeah, this game is not want for depth. There is too much depth, too much unexplained depth. And I feel like if I had had a good grasp on what this game is like and the fact that these battles actually have real strategy to them, I wouldn't have struggled for the first 24 hours of the game.
It sounds like the polar opposite of Mad World.
It is. It's Mad World in reverse.
I mean, I'm just thinking, I think that's probably the Platinum Games title I've played the most of. Unless you count Okami, which is when they were still Clover.
Yeah, it's actually Platinum. I mean, Nude Maker did the primary development for this game.
Wait, Nude Maker?
Yes, Nude Maker.
Yes, that's accurate.
Terrible. Mm-hmm. Terrible.
Well, it's closer to one of their titles. To stuff that they would make. So I think Platinum did the concept.
Well, what does Nude Maker do?
Like they made Steel Battalion.
Oh.
Yeah.
Awesome. They made Now we're in the right context.
Yes, they made Steel Battalion.
That
they
explains
made Clock Tower.
Everything.
Steel Battalion, the most complicated game I've ever seen.
Yes, yep. And played.
Including PC flight simulators.
Yes.
They ain't got nothing on this Xbox game.
Yeah. You know, they've worked with pretty much everybody. And
okay.
This is the kind of shit that Nude Maker makes.
Yeah.
Nude, I would assume. But it's if you like strategy games and RPGs and don't mind having your ass completely beaten every 3 to 4 hours, it's a good game. And
so is this like a secret strategy RPG? It's like,
yeah, it is.
You don't think it is one, but actually it turns out it is.
Yeah, it turns out that for the first 20 hours you can brute force it. And then the game basically says, nope, not anymore.
So you're saying it's kind of like Final Fantasy 13, and then it takes 20 hours to get to the meat of the battle system?
Only if you don't figure it out on your own. Like, when I figured it out on my own, I felt like, shit, I should have figured this out earlier.
Oh, okay. FF13 just won't let you even try.
Yeah, like,
that stuff
I feel like,
later.
And I posted that story in the forums, and I feel like if anybody goes and buys it after seeing that, they will have a much easier time with the first 20 hours of the game.
Yeah.
Because they'll understand, oh, they want me to get close to this guy and punch him in the face, or they want me to stay really, really far away from him because his range is all really tight. Or maybe I should just board him and get this fight over with.
Board him, yeah.
Yeah, and okay. Yeah, that's a whole other part of the game that I'll talk about in the review that's kind of fucked up, but, you know, whatever.
So the end's in sight, then.
Yeah, well, I hope so. I hope it's in sight. Jesus, this game goes on forever. I am at 36 hours now.
Yeah.
Which is long for a DS game.
It's pretty long.
And I think there's another 10 hours behind it, so. So do we want to talk about, since we're already on Nude Maker, do we want to talk about Steel Battalion now?
Well, we talked about it on the Sleepcast.
Yeah, I'm curious though, like that video that John posted of us playing Steel Battalion.
Oh, I need to see that.
Yeah, it's just John playing it, and I want to point out that I was MVP of this team.
I didn't get actually any gameplay footage. It was just
I was killed
in action.
Yeah, I watched Johnny get killed.
Actual video footage of the game isn't really that interesting. The controller is what's amazing.
Yeah, it really is.
The game is very slow paced. What you see on the screen is. It only even makes sense if you're sitting in front of the controller, because a lot of the things that you see in the UI for Steel Battalion match up with things that are down on the controller.
Yep.
So if you're just watching like a video capture, I don't think there's a whole lot to see there. And I mean, you know, you might occasionally see another robot show up in the crosshairs and then you pull the trigger, but it looks like every other mech game you've ever seen, especially
actually,
like
it's even slower and more tedious than most mech games.
Right, yeah. But it's very similar to like Mech Warrior 2, which was pretty slow on its own too. I think in recent years, most mech games have moved more towards being more fast-paced.
Right.
With Mech Assault and even Chrome Hounds is sometimes more fast-paced.
No, never.
Depends.
Never fast-paced.
It depends. But anyway, yeah, but Steel Battalion is super slow and methodical.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the methodical part doesn't come across very well in video, but it makes sense when you're sitting in front of the controller.
When I finally had control over that thing and understood what was going on, I was like, oh my god, this is awesome. And then... and then I shot that guy, and I killed him, and that was the end of the game. Because ours ended quick, because our team wiped out the other team. Versus the other group that had 15 minutes, we only had like 8.5, because we just trounced them.
And the first 5 were learning to walk.
Yeah, it was like, because I fell over one time, and then I heard you fell over, and then the person between us fell over.
I think you fall over if you're in fifth gear, because there's a gear shift.
Yes.
And if you're in fifth gear and you turn too hard,
yes,
you'll fall over. So what you want to do is like downshift and then turn.
Or if you're in fifth gear and you're going perpendicular to the slope of a hill, you can fall over.
It's too realistic to be fun.
I disagree. I think when you get a handle on it, it can be a lot of fun. Because I mean,
it's like Flight Simulator. Like that shit bores me to tears. I'd rather watch C-SPAN 2. But there are people who are so enraptured by the realism of Flight Simulator that they can sit there for hours. I know some of these people, and they build these crazy Steel Battalion like control areas, you know, with gyroscopic chairs and crazy shit. And people get so into it. To me, it's like Gran Turismo. Again, it's so realistic, it's not actually fun. But obviously, millions and millions of people disagree.
Well, not millions and millions in the case of Steel Battalion.
Yeah,
thousands and thousands.
You just have to be the right kind of personality for it. And I'm definitely more of the quick action kind of stuff.
Yeah, it really is closer to what I would play regularly. And if I end up buying Steel Battalion, I'm going to hate myself. But...
you should be proud, man.
It was just like, okay.
I don't think anybody could say that they're more hardcore than you if you regularly play Steel Battalion online.
No, that's pretty much it.
It is.
I did like that the person who owned mine had to do like a repair to it and had replaced one of the switches with like a wire hanger hook because the switch had come off, and it worked. It's just even better. I was like, it's a real mech. He's had to do repairs on the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, anyway, we should move on. And John, all I've got down for you is Choaniki Zero.
Yeah, that's all you really need to have down, actually, Johnny.
Now, did you get to play any of the Mommy's Best Games? Have you downloaded those yet?
No, I have not downloaded any of those yet. I really haven't done any gaming. I've just been really busy at work and haven't had a lot of time.
I do want to get your impressions on Weapon of Choice, though, because you haven't actually – they didn't have that for play at PAX, so
– they did not.
I'm really curious to hear your thoughts on that. I got home and I booted it up and played a few minutes of it and just put a big smile on my face, so
– yeah, I'm definitely going to play it. I'll play it this week. But yeah, so Choaniki Zero, I figured – I saw that it came out and, you know, I was kind of curious about it, you could say.
Magic the Gathering curious about it.
Yeah.
Oh.
And so I saw that it was, because if it was a retail release, I wasn't sure if it was a retail release or a PSN release. And I saw that it was on PSN, which piqued my interest. So I was sitting there at PAX and we were waiting to get into, we were waiting in the huge line. I think it was me, James, and Mike. So yeah, so I decided to, while we were sitting there, we're waiting to get into the closing ceremonies / Omegathon.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And we waited there for probably like, how long do you think, James? Like hour and a half?
I think Carl and I were there for 45 minutes and we had to leave.
So I was just really bored and they had free Wi-Fi. So I said, you know what the hell? I mean.
Wait, the Wi-Fi was working in there?
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's the PAX miracle right there.
Yeah, it was working. So yeah, I mean it's Choaniki. It's not as outrageous as I thought it would be. But the thing is, what they've kind of done.
You should ask for your money back.
Yeah, that's the thing. I haven't gotten too deep into the game.
Oh yeah.
The thing is, what
it's all about the death.
What they've beefed up,
love that
if you will,
from Greg.
is kind of what the kind of artwork and art design that they've wrapped around it. For example, there's a lot more kind of like anime style stuff, like strange, weird stuff though. Not really like kind of, it's just weird stuff. Like when you die, it shows I think it's your two options. What is it, Samson and Adon, the two guys that come out in Speedos and they, it's, I don't even know why. You know how most shooters, when you die, it has the countdown, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Instead of a countdown, it shows an, like a picture, like an anime style picture of Samson and Adon hugging each other, and you have to sit there and press the X button repeatedly. It doesn't count anything down. You just sit there pressing X, and it says like pound the button, and you have to sit there and press X. And then
that's more sexual than you realize, John.
But what's the best though is when you succeed, the screen fades out and it fades in, and there's a big like rose garden in front of you.
Oh no!
It's just roses on the screen.
I think we call that the post-coital period, John.
Yeah. I mean, the whole thing, it's, yeah, and I haven't really seen anything too weird enemy-wise yet. I mean, you get your, you know, you get your strange things, like, you know, the half-naked men in the...
Levels of weirdness here.
Yeah, there's levels of weirdness. I haven't seen anything overtly phallic yet, let me put it that way.
Yeah, there's no, like, giant... screen-filling boss that is a penis and from which another penis.
No, no. There's nothing like that. I've fought a couple of sort of, I guess, mid-level bosses and
that's
one.
That's the Saturn game.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing, you see. The Jomaniki games got progressively more ridiculous as far as I could see. So given this is a prequel, perhaps they've kind of tried to maintain that like, direction of travel.
Is there enough story in Jomaniki to necessitate a prequel?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Was there enough story in Street Fighter, James?
Well, the thing is, what I've learned is that in every one of these games, there's several elements that kind of... There's several common elements. There's the Emperor Balzac.
Junior. This is Balzac Junior, if you
There's Protein.
Correctly.
There's the Builder Planet.
I think man beams. See, now I just have this image of us reading that Choenhe description from the European Virtual Channel again.
Yeah, it was awesome.
It's a legendary
Emperor Builder, I think he was called in that, rather than Balzac, somewhat more provocative.
Yeah, yeah. This in this one, he's Emperor Balzac from the Builder Planet. There's so many weird little things, like on the load screen, it's a black screen, but in the bottom right corner, it says,
Uh-oh.
Oh God, here it comes.
I told you, it's the post-coital period after it loads.
So, it's Choenhe Zero.
Somebody had fun localizing that.
Is it a good shoot 'em up? Dare I ask that question?
Wait,
it's very
here?
Similar to the one that's on VC. Very similar.
Mm.
It's okay.
Is there a man beam?
Yeah, there's a couple of different, and it's what's funny, what's actually, what I like about it is that there's a lot of really cheesy Japanese voiceovers, either in Japanese or really terrible English.
Good.
Like, mana beam! And, you know, everything goes crazy, everything goes haywire on the screen. And, there's actually, I think when you hit the man beam, it flashes a crazy anime thing of, like, one of the bodybuilder guys across the screen. So... Yeah, it's Choenhe. So kind of the jury's
game.
Still out. I would say that right now it's probably not worth the $20 I bought it for, but
I would argue that just for the segment alone it's probably worth that.
Yeah. I mean, I will say that it's the one game that you can't avoid beating on hard. There you go.
I think it is the first Choenhe game released in the U.S. on a first run.
Yeah. It seems to be sort of a remake or an homage to the one that's currently on VC. Because in the one that's on VC, there's this weird choo-choo train boss that you fight, of course, in the middle of outer space. And that boss also makes an appearance in this game, so I have a feeling that it's kind of a remake, or maybe a reimagining, if you will, of the Choenhe legend.
Imagine. You know, the funny thing is, I bet John thought up that beating on hard joke on the flight home and has been holding onto it all week.
Oh, I've had that in the pocket for a while.
It's not the only thing, John. Not the only thing.
It just makes me wonder if this is a sin and punishment kind of situation where this maybe the sales on Virtual Console were so good that they decided to go ahead and release this in the U.S. as a download title, which is a low cost,
or maybe
low cost
they just,
of entry anyway.
I mean, it probably didn't cost them anything to localize it. I mean,
probably didn't cost them anything to make. I mean, let's be honest.
Wow. Okay. Not much. But.
I mean, they probably just said, you know what, fuck it. We'll do it live and just put it out.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like you couldn't make a more niche game for a more niche console.
Let's put it on the console
a
that
download
no one
PSP
plays.
Title.
Like, I'm proud to say that I'm like one of 100 people in North America that bought that game.
You're proud to say you're one of 8 people at PAX who had a PSP.
I think it was very detailed market research that the one thing that shameless pirates will pay for is homoerotic shooters.
So, I raised my hand.
Audience.
I think they just knew John was an active PSP user and said, you know what? There's this guy.
There's this one guy.
It's like the Truman Show of video game publishing. It's all about John.
This was a game made for you, personally.
Well, that was like my one kind of comment at PAX was that you saw absolutely no PSPs there whatsoever. There were none.
I literally saw no PSP Go's.
I saw one. At one point, I saw four guys playing PSP. Three of them had an older one, and then the fourth guy had a Go. They were playing together, presumably.
Yeah, we were
crazy about the Go. It's like in Japan, the PSP does really quite well.
Yeah.
Every week, and yet the Go sells about 1,000 units a week.
Yeah. I mean, it's
even there, it's a complete disaster.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because I remember that now because I think we were headed to the handheld free play.
Yeah.
And they were all kind of camped out over there. Which, by the way, if you have a PSP Go, the handheld free play sucks.
Really? What do they have?
Well, you can't because it's PSP Go.
You can't check
There's
out.
There's no UMD slot on it.
I mean, did they have a whole bunch of PSP games there?
They had some.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, they had a lot of DS games too. I checked out Nanostray 2, which is a game I reviewed the first Nanostray and liked it, and I always heard that the second one was way better, and it does seem to be very, very good, but I never played it before. And then I played some Uendon 2. That was the cool thing. They had some Japanese games, so you know, I owned the first Uendon, and of course I own Elite Beat Agents, but then Uendon 2 came out after that, and I never played the sequel, so I messed around with that. And then I ended up playing John's copy of Dark Void Zero because he left his DSi there, and so I played 5 minutes of that.
And I played Pinball of the Dead for the GBA, which I played for 5 minutes and played everything. And I left John a message on his Flipnote Studio.
I have not checked that out yet.
Oh, you should go check that right now.
Let me see what I can do this here.
It's not dirty. It's
funny. No, it's just like, how long does it take to do anything in Flipnote Studio? And I was surprised how little time it takes, actually.
Yeah, I haven't messed with it myself. But yeah, just one last thing about the PSP Go. I mean, one reason, Greg, that it sells so poorly, even in Japan, where PSP is kind of popular, is that, I mean, keep in mind, in the US at least, it costs $50 more than the DSi XL, which is already crazy overpriced.
Yeah,
it's $249 in the U.S. I mean, it's literally $100 overpriced.
It's $100, yeah, and it's a smaller screen than the original PSP, and it has less functionality.
At least $100 overpriced.
Yeah, it's the most mispriced product ever.
Really, the sweet zone for me for a PSP is probably about $129, like where the DS Lite is now. That's about where I would go for it. But $150, I might actually buy it on a Go. But, you know, even when Sony does inevitably drop the price, probably sooner than later, they're probably
really
going to bring it down to $200. And even then, it's competitive with a system that, I mean, it, you know, say what you will about the DSi XL, it's a better system than the Go.
No question.
If I was going to buy one of them at that price, I might even buy the XL. So
I mean, that thing should be $100.
But I'm not going to buy either one at that price. You know,
I mean, it's a 5-year-old console. I mean, come on, man.
I was doing a little research the other day, and you know, the GBA SP launched at $99.
It did, yes.
New. And so did the Micro. So,
which
I mean,
was stupid at the time.
This is really pretty unprecedented. I mean, I know the DSi was considered kind of a price increase, but it did add quite a bit of functionality.
Yeah.
The XL really doesn't. So.
I think it may be, I mean, with specific reference to America, but even Europe these days, I think it's been commented on that the consoles have kind of been you have remained high in price, but I think with the handhelds being particularly sticky, I think it is related to the relative strengthening of the yen since the GBA SP period in particular. You know, that for Sony and Nintendo, the revenue that they're getting from the Western markets is worth less than it was back in the early part of the last decade, and so they're more inclined to do this sort of sleight of hand stuff and increase the price of the DSi or a PSP Go because they feel like they're clawing back stuff that they should be getting that's been denied them by the currency markets, essentially.
Spoken like an analyst. So I'm last up with new business. I emailed these guys a list of literally like 20 games that I could have talked about. Some of them only very, very, very briefly. But I narrowed it down to three for this week, so we'll see how I do on this. So the most pertinent one for the Nintendo audience is WarioWare DIY Showcase, which is the WiiWare game, the channel. I do not own the DS game. I really have no interest. It's, like I talked about on the panel last week, the Showcase is awesome in theory because it's $8 and I get to play all the games and I get access to the new ones from the internet and from other people without actually having to pay for all the game development suite, which I don't care about. Like, I'm not going to mess with anyway. So it's great for me. And it's basically what I expected. WarioWare Showcase, it's even less than I thought. I thought it was $10 last week. It's actually $8. Mm-hmm. And you get, I think, 72 micro games, which is a pretty fair number. It's not quite as many as you would get in one of the previous games, I think.
Really? That seems pretty close to...
No, I think the quotes are usually like somewhere over 100 in previous games. Then
yeah, they usually have over 100.
Yeah, in DIY itself, I think there's 90. So you're pretty close to that in terms of the microgames that are on the card.
Yeah, and some of those might be the incomplete ones that you're supposed to complete through the tutorials. So maybe that might be why they're not in the showcase. But anyway, it does have a number of games, and you can definitely spend a couple of hours just playing the microgames that are in there, which is already pretty close to the value I would get out of a typical WarioWare game that would cost me $30 or $40. So already, if I'm feeling this is a pretty damn good value, and then I go to the Nin Shop or the Ninsoft store, I think, where you download things that Nintendo's put up there, and there's already four games up. There's the one that Sakurai made, which is on. There's a video of him making it on Nintendo Channel, but it's this line. It's like called Line Slash or something. It's actually pretty difficult. And then there's one by Yoshio Sakamoto where you just shoot it at Metroids, which is, it's neat for the artwork, basically. It's not actually that much fun. It's not that interesting gameplay-wise, but it's neat. He drew some character art for Samus that pops up at the end of it. That's pretty cool. And then there were a couple of fairly crude-looking ones that Nintendo just put up in a general sense. Probably the original development team made them. And those are really interesting games, actually. I like both of those. And they're supposed to be putting up two of those every week, and then the big name games, I guess, whenever they're done or whenever they get them. But yeah, I mean, in the end, I don't know how many games I'm going to end up having in it, but I've already got 76, and the number's going up, which, again, I just think it's a good value.
Mm.
The only thing I'm a little disappointed in is the interface for getting games from other people, because the way it's set up, you can transfer games from a local DS, but not an online DS. And you can transfer games from another person's copy of WarioWare Showcase, but you can only send, you can't get. So you can't, like, go and see what games... I can't go and see what game Zach Miller has on his copy of WarioWare Showcase. I just have to wait for him to send some to me, or I have to send him an email or something and say, hey, send me some games you made. So I was hoping that there'd be some kind of repository of games that all of my friends had made, or something like that, or even just games that random people had made that I could just go browse through, just kind of like the Me Showcase channel or whatever, where you can just go and, you know, and just browse through things that people have made.
Can you rate games, Johnny?
Well, there is an option for someone to send you a survey along with their game so that you can kind of rate it.
That's so absurd.
No one's done that yet, so I don't know what's involved in the survey, but it's not something you can just do.
I mean, but Boomblocks Bash Party's got a great sort of interface for pulling up like levels of a certain type. Like, if you're playing a level of a certain type, it's just got a button right there that says, look for levels like this one that people have made.
I wonder if it's got something to do with they don't really know how well these games are going to translate from DS to the Wii.
No. I mean, they all work really, really well.
Well, I mean, and they don't know what people make. So this is kind of their way of making sure somebody doesn't upload their Choaniki-eyed WarioWare game where it's...
Well, yeah, I think there's definitely some censorship to it. Because you have a lot more creativity in making one of these micro games than you do in making a Mii, right?
Yeah, we've seen what you can do with the Mii. Now imagine if you could actually draw his face.
Right. Yeah. So, no, I'm sure that's a big part of it, is just the censorship, but it's disappointing.
When Zach inevitably sends you a level where you play as a penis... It's your fault for accepting Zach's levels.
Yeah, but the thing is, I can't go get Zach's levels. I have to wait for him to download the WiiWare channel. He can't even do it from his DS. He can't send a game from his DS to my WiiWare channel unless he was here, physically here.
So his DS connects to his Wii wirelessly.
Right, so he has to put it from his DS to his Wii, which means he has to buy the $8 channel, and then he can send it from his Wii to my Wii. But what it can't do is send it from a DS to a Wii over the internet.
That is so complicated.
I can't think of any other game that does connect a DS to a Wii over the internet. It's something that you really only ever do locally. But I just had it in my mind. I was expecting it to be able to do that, and it doesn't. So the only way to send peer-to-peer over the internet is for you both to have the WiiWare channel, which is okay. I mean, if you own the DS game, I think you probably would want to get the WiiWare channel anyway, because it is really cool to see your games up on the TV screen. You can show other people a lot more easily, and now you have another way where you can send it to other people.
So I'm guessing you don't get the WiiWare channel for free if you buy the DS game, do you?
No, you really should. Really, really, really should. They should have included a download code for it, because they can do that. I mean, we've seen that they do have the tech to do that, and I think they really should have. But they want their $8.
I wonder how effective this may be. Obviously, it's good for someone like you who's really not interested in generating the content yourself, but I wonder if it will be effective with anyone who kind of isn't sure whether they want to do that sort of stuff, and then they play other people's stuff on the Showcase channel, and then actually, it kind of breaks them down. They think, I would like to try creating stuff. And
right. Yeah, I can see it being a marketing tool.
It could sell somebody on just the WarioWare concept in general, too.
It's just an interesting idea relative to other user-generated content games. You can't sort of play someone's Little Big Planet levels that they've made without owning Little Big Planet.
Yeah.
Which I am going to get. It's becoming greatest hits for $30, so I will be picking up Little Big Planet very soon.
What I'm interested in, and I've actually seen the level maker in action now, it is
complicated.
It's a lot of work, and I'm not sure that people are going to have the patience to sit there and create these really intricate and fun levels. I'm concerned that the only really good levels we're going to get out there are going to be the ones that Nintendo makes.
Well, it's interesting. There are ways to, basically, it has the ability to send games from your DS to another person's DS if you exchange friend codes. And then they can critique it, but they can also edit it and send it back to you, almost PictoChat style.
That's cool.
I can see actually, friends, even if they're across the world, I can see friends who both have it and are interested in doing this, teaming up and actually working on something collaboratively, which could be really cool.
Yeah.
So I do think because of features like that, eventually you'll start to see some good things. And there is a place on the download store, along with the stuff from Nintendo, there's a place for them to host games that have been selected from user submissions. So I assume in the DS version, there's a place where you can upload a level you've made to Nintendo for consideration, like you could with Smash Bros.
Yeah,
Brother
I mean,
level.
They've done stuff like that before, like Mario versus DK 2, March of the Minis or whatever. They're a very similar thing where you could make your own levels and then you'd submit them and then they'd republish like the ones they liked.
Yeah, I mean, if they had contests going and stuff like that, incentivize people to make these things. I mean,
they will do that, yeah.
Something like that. I mean, that community can go on for as long as Nintendo wants it to.
Yeah,
so I think there's a lot of potential there. I'm with James. I'm worried that the editor is so involved that a lot of people will be turned off from it.
Isn't that a big part of the game, really, though, is kind of the whole thing of, like, Wario, quote-unquote, taking you through how to develop the games?
Oh, yeah, no, there are plenty of tutorials. In fact, Pedro's been bitching about them a lot because he's reviewing this for us. And the tutorials are so long and complicated that they're actually getting on his nerves. So certainly, it's not like it just throws you in the deep end and says, make a game.
No.
I think it meticulously walks you through every single part of the process. But it's just intimidating, It just seems like so much work.
It's funny because it feels like a real development tool. Because when we went by Nintendo's Boothette, as you might want to call it... there was a guy there who was making a level, and the woman who was working the booth, the actual person who interacted with people, not the person who took your picture with your DSi XL, she was looking over his shoulder as he was making stuff, probably to make sure he wasn't making a penis-themed level. He was there for about an hour, because I came back around later, and he was still working on it.
Same guy.
It was the same guy, and he was finishing up the level he had made, and I didn't get to see it.
That must have been the worst job for demoing ever. Just watching one person sit there.
It's not a game that would demo on the floor.
If that's your thing, I mean, which it might be mine, I'm not sure. But if that's your thing, that's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's cool that that guy obviously got into it.
I think if it clicks with you, that game could eat your life up.
Mm-hmm.
Because I could totally see it turning into like a project that I work on, and I'm like, oh my god, this is amazing. Let me just tweak this.
Anyway, I will move on to Final Fantasy 13. I had barely played it before I went to PAX, just like an hour, maybe two. At this point, I think I'm 5 or 6 hours in, so I'm starting to feel like I'm really getting somewhere. I'm in somewhere in Chapter 3, pretty late in Chapter 3, I think. And the battle system has opened up quite a bit. The battles are getting more complicated, more interesting. I've died a few times now, even on regular enemies. Like, sometimes they will just gang up, and if you don't understand how the enemies behave, you're screwed. But it's easy to learn that. I mean, you know, you die once, you'll probably figure out what you did wrong. So it's not frustrating.
And you gotta restart there and then, don't you?
That's right. It just says retry, and bam, you're right back there. You don't have to load from your previous save. There are tons of save points. Actually, one thing I would comment is that so far the linearity isn't really bothering me, because the game's pretty exciting, and it is so beautiful. Just, I can't even put it into words how beautiful the game is. I think in a lot of places it actually looks better than The Spirits Within, the movie that the Square made about 10, 12 years ago that was CG. It just is a strikingly attractive game, and that goes a long way into keeping your interest. You know, I mean, if you're impressed by the pretty colors and the amazing models, and I would say, I mean, yeah, a lot of Final Fantasy 13 is watching movies, and you can draw the comparison to like Metal Gear Solid 4, which is famously like really movie heavy. But mm-hmm. The difference is in Metal Gear, and this goes back to all the previous Metal Gear Solids as well, but the movies quite often are people standing around talking. There's not a whole lot to look at there. They're just trying to get across dialogue. And then they also have these codec screens, which are just dialogue. So there's tons of that shit too.
And also the fact that the story is incomprehensible most of the time.
Well, incomprehensible, or just you wouldn't want to comprehend it if you tried.
Yeah. Well, in FF13, anytime you're not controlling the game, you will at least be interested in what's happening, because the cinema scenes tend to be very action-oriented, or the characters are at least on the move. You know, they're walking and talking or running and talking at the same time. And there's not that much dialogue. There's no like codec, like there's no analog to the codec scenes. You're never going to see people just standing around talking for 5-10 minutes. It just doesn't happen. So yeah, the game is very cinematic, and it's very heavy on movie scenes, but it's like watching an actual movie, like mm-hmm. an action movie. It's like watching an anime. So it's more exciting than it is in Metal Gear. The story is very interesting. It's pretty obtuse to start with. People are throwing around terms like Falci and Lissi and Pulse and Cocoon, and you're like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah.
It is worth going into the menu screen and reading a couple of the text blurbs to explain these terms. And you don't have to spend hours doing that. You can do that in 5 minutes. And just reading that, you'll be like, oh, okay, I kind of get that. And then as you continue to play the game, you'll actually see these things, and you'll be like, oh yeah, I know what that is. And the story makes way, way, way more sense. So I've heard some people say that you need to spend hours and hours, like in Mass Effect, reading all these codex entries and stuff like that. I think you could probably do that, but it's total overkill. You don't need to know that much, but the game probably would have benefited from explaining a couple of things to start with. But, you know, in true anime fashion, they like to just jump right into something and just let you figure it out as you go. But the battle system, I feel unqualified to comment on it too much, just because I know that they're still adding things to it. And, you know, I wish some of these things were rolled out a lot sooner. Especially like the paradigm shift and some of that stuff, the job system, basically. That could have been done right from the start. You didn't need to have an hour where you're literally just pushing attack. In a way, it's funny that people are so critical of that, because if you go back to all the previous Final Fantasies, usually because your character starts out at level 1 with maybe a sword, it's not unusual to spend the first hour of a Final Fantasy game just running around and attacking everything.
Yeah, but that's just 1 hour.
Well, but that's all it is in 13, too. I mean, it doesn't take that long before you get magic and stuff like that. And then it really becomes a very different game, and it becomes a lot more interesting. And Anyway, I mean, I'm going to be playing this for a long time to come. It's a long game, so I'm not going to go crazy overboard with it today, but I just do want to say I'm way into it. You know, I would really like to go and play some more tonight. I even played like 15 minutes before the podcast. I'm like, do I have time for some Final Fantasy? Yeah, okay, fuck it. I'm gonna play a few battles.
So mean, how's the pacing? Does it just keep moving along?
Yeah, very much.
Yeah.
It's very much like a roller coaster. It's just, you know, push, 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 push. Again, it's not that much different from other Final Fantasies. It's just, it's presented in such a more honest way that it makes you step back a little bit. And I get that.
The main thing I've sort of perceived from the coverage of this so far is a sort of what I detect to be a certain irony of it. It's frequently referred to as sort of being streamlined in many ways in terms of, you know, relative linearity and kind of, you know, taking out the kind of totally trivial battles and like focusing it into battles, like you said, where even sort of relatively basic enemies can kill you, but then, you know, if you fail, you just restart and all this kind of stuff. So it's streamlined. But on the other hand, it takes 20 hours to get going. I mean, that doesn't make me think
but
of streamlined being streamlined.
That's such an exaggeration. Like I said, I've been playing for like 5, and I feel like it's been going for an hour or two already.
Yeah. I mean, the way people talk about it, you would think that you're sitting there grinding in one spot for 20 hours, and then you start playing.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
That is completely
untrue. My understanding was just that basically kind of artificially held the game's intricacies back to space them out over the length of the game, which is very long because it has to be very long.
That's right. It is legally mandated, this game.
That was my sort of interpretation of,
that,
of the...
That
of,
may
of,
be true.
Which, what I mean by that is not streamlined at all.
Right, no. No, I mean, I think it coddles you too much in the very beginning, like the first chapter. There's no... Like a baby could play through the first chapter of the game. Like
Like this game so easy I could beat it by slapping against my butt first chapter, or is it
pretty much? Nice. I mean, the first chapter is more about introducing you to the world and the characters than it is about introducing you to the battle system. That comes more in the next one or two chapters. And I understand why they might not want to throw every element of the battle system at you to start with, because it would probably be overwhelming. You know, it's a complicated system. There's a lot of new stuff in it that you haven't done before. It would probably blow everybody's minds if they did that. So I understand rolling these things out. I just think the way they roll out the mechanics could probably be more compressed. But I wasn't bored through the first hour. Some people apparently are. I wasn't. And then very quickly it started to feel like, oh, now I'm getting somewhere. And like I said, now I'm very interested in the gameplay, and I'm still not that far into it. So I'm pretty excited to see what more is to come. One last thing I'll cover extremely briefly is the PSN download title for PS3. It's called Everyday Shooter. It's like 3 years old. It's been out for a long time.
Yep.
But it went on sale this week for $5. And when I got my PS3, it was one of the games I'd heard about that I was kind of interested in, but then I found out there's no demo and it's $10. That really puts it on the borderline for me.
Yeah, especially when you don't really know if you like it or not.
Right, yeah. And it's a very weird game, too. So I'll hold off.
Mm-hmm.
But when I saw it for $5, I didn't even think about it. Go. And it's really interesting. It's another one of these games that's developed entirely by one dude. And it's very, very interesting. It's basically, I described it earlier, as like a cross between Geometry Wars and Electroplankton. Because it is like a twin-stick shooter, and you're moving around and shooting these shapes, basically. But the game is super psychedelic, and it's all kind of... The action on the screen is kind of synced up with the rhythm of the music and the sound effects and things like that. It looks really cool. And the other nice thing is that every level is basically like 3 or 4 minutes long, because it's timed with the length of the song that's playing. So it's like Luminous, I guess, in that regard. But then you move to the next level, and it's a completely different style. It's a different art style, it's a different music style, and the score mechanics change. So every single stage has a completely different way of scoring your performance. They all have these different chain combos and things like that. So it's almost like a puzzle. Every time you get to a new level, you have to figure out, well, how does this level work? You know, where do I shoot to set off the chain reaction that blows up everything on the screen and saves my ass? And that's pretty cool to figure that out, you know, and to learn to exploit it. So I'm having a blast with it. I think it's really good, definitely worth $5. So that's Everyday Shooter, totally weird game. But if you're into Geometry Wars and stuff like that, I think you'll like it a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
You got it too, John?
Yeah, I've had that for a long time.
Do you play it every day?
No, I don't. Because I have 1,000 other games to play, and I've had it for about 2 years.
That's good shit, though.
Translation, no, Johnny, fuck you.
Yeah.
Translation, he's never played it.
I have played it. Actually,
that's
played
not true, because there's no collector's edition to put on his shelf.
Oh, here we go.
There's no night vision goggles you could get with this game.
I think if you played everyday shooter with night vision goggles,
you might be able to make some
save
sense
a lot of
it.
Money on drugs. okay, well, that's the end of new business. We're going to take a break, come back with final thoughts on PAX and your listener mail. Be right back. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. So this week we've had all kinds of stuff about PAX 2010, PAX East, I should say, which we were at, of course. Lots of video blogs, podcasts, drunk casts, etc. And there's even more to come. We actually have some videos still.
NHL 94 with a surprise ending, so stay tuned for that.
Mm-hmm.
The two-headed Hydra known as Neil and Zach have put together a review for Pokemon Heart Gold and Soul Silver, which is essentially Pokemon Gold and Silver as a remake of and every other Pokemon game to date, with the same problems and the same other stuff, except now there's a Pokewalker, which seems neat but, quote, unnecessary.
Pokewalkers were kind of a big deal at PAX East.
Kind of. I saw more Pokewalkers than I saw sane-looking people.
I saw more Pokewalkers than I saw PSPs.
Oh, no, yes. No, not even close. Not even close, like 10-1. And the game had only been out, what, like a week?
No, that's the thing, timing is everything. Neil reviews Red Steel 2, which he says is repetitive in some areas, but it was a great art style and is pure arcade fun. It also makes excellent use of Wii Motion Plus. I also understand myself that it has a special technique referred to as the Cobra, so my anticipation rating for this has gone up significantly.
That's right.
I can't wait to play that.
And when you use it, 86 guys on motorcycles die instantly.
Yep. All right, on the blog end, we have Mike Gammon. Pale, as the public knows him. He gives us a DSi XL unboxing, I'm sure. You know, this is probably much the same unboxing that went on in James Jones's house when he got the DSi huge. And he
Except just gives us
a bunch of pictures of it. You know, it's an unboxing feature, people. What do you want?
Well, I like that he lines it up with all the other versions of DS and Game Boy.
Yeah, he gives a comparative screenshot with every... I mean, he owns every single portable you can possibly have.
Yeah, you've got the micro there for the maximum disparity.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It's the opposite direction.
All right, well, that's the content on NintendoWorldReport.com this week, so check it out. Back to the show. Before we get into the listener mail, I wanted to wrap up our last thoughts on Penny Arcade Expo East 2010, and specifically the last thing that we recorded while we were there was the drunk cast, which I guess actually I'd kind of like to hear Greg's thoughts on the whole podcast suite.
Yeah, so I think the first thing I'll say, I think my faith in how well you delivered on the panel I expressed before you left was vindicated. I think you did very well.
Thank you very much.
And me being the long-time fan of the show that I am, inevitably it was just great to hear Carl and Mike again. I always enjoy listening to them. Carl had plenty of very good things to say about it.
Those two really delivered, actually, on the panel.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. I
thought so very much. Not to diminish the contributions of the three of you, obviously. So the panel went really well. And, you know, I thought it was interesting. It was something of a shame that the questioners at some point forgot to start mentioning their names.
It was
a little bit of a shame. However, I thought it illustrated the fact that their primary concern was actually contributing to a discussion rather than getting a name check and saying an asinine catchphrase.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, the name thing was more for us. Like, I just wanted to hear that. But
yeah.
Oh, no, you always do. It just seemed like they wanted to get right in there into the discussion.
Yeah.
And then the rest, I have some thoughts from the rest of the event that I will sort of put under the heading of things that I learned from PAX East 2010.
Oh, jeez.
Did you write this down?
The first one is, Sin and Punishment 2 is doomed, and this is because the co-founder of a Nintendo podcast is under the impression that it's a WiiWare game that lasts 30 minutes.
I know, I heard that and just groaned. I was like,
yeah, that was pretty cringeworthy.
It's probably going to sell 100,000 copies at most on that basis.
Yeah, but, you know, Mike isn't... He's not all that up on
I know, but, I mean, what about
it's
the
not,
average...
It's not Rock Band.
Yeah, therefore, you know, it's not a track pack, so he really doesn't know.
Well, I do think Nintendo needs, especially Nintendo of America, is going to have to do a good job of explaining to people what this is, you know. But they've been putting out some great trailers for Metroid and Mario this week, and Sin and Punishment comes out before... Metroid. Yes. So I mean, they really need to start promoting this and getting people interested.
It's been out for months. There's plenty of footage they could be showing. I really think they should go do a sort of Back to the Future style thing. And like, you know that Star Fox-like game you've been waiting for? Well, listen to this. You know, that's,
this isn't it, but it's close.
That's pretty much what they should do, because it is a lot like the Star Fox game you've been waiting for 13 years.
Yeah.
If you want to approach it from that angle. Anyway... Yeah. Proceeding with the things that I learned from the show, I learned that of all the possible reasons for James' consistently intemperate demeanor, roid rage isn't one of them, from actually seeing his physique. He has not been juicing all the time.
Wow.
So
I'm not sure how to take that.
James is a normally shaped person, I will
exactly.
say.
Exactly. That's
his
the
defense.
Point. I had wondered whether...
He's a misanthrope, but I mean, come on.
To be fair, you know, it's not like there aren't pictures of me available to be seen.
Yeah, they're all in post offices on the wall.
Oh dear, man. Wow. I was wondering whether he was going to look like, you know, Stallone post-human growth hormone kind of era. And maybe that was, you know, your hateful attitude towards so many things was just an unfortunate side effect of that.
Greg, you're really grasping for rationale of James's personality, but he was born that way.
I guess you just have
to accept some things.
That I will admit that sometimes I do play it up for the sake of it being entertaining, and for the, I enjoy, you know, playing it up a little bit too. So it's
I just think you're a sourpuss.
Oh, whatever.
The next thing I think probably the star of the drunk cast was the sexmo. Now, I was fairly certain that I heard that before pointed it out, so I haven't really gone back and absolutely verified it, but I'm quite confident of it.
I didn't make it up. I mean, I thought I heard it. I don't know if I actually heard it. But...
You heard it because I looked up when I heard it said. I'm like, is anybody going to comment on that?
Now, it could be because Carl was about to say techmo and sexual harassment in the same sentence, and it came out as sexmo. I prefer to believe that it is the name of Carl's controversial Louis Armstrong erotica act that he does.
Whoa.
In which things other than trumpets are blown on a quite an obscene way.
And I said to myself,
what a wonderful world.
Wow.
Indeed.
I really can't believe you just referenced Louis Armstrong. That's amazing.
Oh, God. The funny thing is when he said that, I thought of Satchmo. That's the first thing I thought of, but there's
exactly.
no way
that's
I would say it out loud.
That's how we got there.
It was just too strange.
I learned that Johnny teaching people how to play magic is a lot funnier in theory than it is in reality.
Yeah, I had a feeling that wasn't going to be all that.
I haven't listened to that. But
it sort of loses something because when I was just listening to you guys do it, you were like, oh, okay, he played that card. That means it's like, what card, Johnny? I don't know what the fuck you look at.
Yeah, I tried to narrate it, you know, as well as I could. Probably did a better job in the beginning than as we went on. But I did try to call out the names of the cards because I knew we were recording it. But it was really hard to basically be the commentator while actually playing the game and actually trying to teach them at the same time. So I was juggling a lot of responsibilities while we did that.
And the final thing, appropriately enough, that I learned from Pats is that, but yeah, BitTrip Runner is the new Gong. So anytime anything has gone on too long, it needs to be stopped. You just say, but yeah, BitTrip Runner.
That's Neil's line.
And then you bring the conversation to its screeching halt.
Yeah. Boy, that was, yeah, I listened to the drunk cast today, and it definitely had me laughing in a few places, but there were moments where you had to be there, for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can only assume.
Yeah, indeed.
It felt like at significant portions of time where the fact we were recording was completely oblivious to most people.
Those are the best moments, I would say.
John is either a lightweight or drank three times more
than
everyone else.
John fell off the fucking bed.
John, I think John's actually just a lightweight.
Yeah, I don't drink very much.
The most cogent thing that John said during the whole broadcast was, man, fuck Super Mario Galaxy 2.
By the way, that was the most cogent thing John said during the whole weekend.
That's not true.
We had so much fun.
Yeah, again, that's one of those things. It's like the Magic Cast where I'm not sure what percentage of the people who listen to it will actually enjoy it, but we had such a good time that I was hoping that some of our... you know, some of our exuberance during the actual event would make it into the recording and would transfer to listeners. So hopefully it did. If not, I'm sorry. Obviously, we're back to the usual thing now. So it's not like we do that every week.
Yeah, it's back to the usual thing where I ruthlessly excise exuberance.
Well, yes. To be honest, if you had excised exuberance, all you would have had is somebody trying to set fire to the hotel room and John falling off of a bed.
That was actually a scary moment. I think it
that
comes
was
across
really
pretty
scary,
well.
Yeah, because they're going, oh my God, his hand is trembling while he's lighting this match.
So anyway, Greg, I take it in general you've enjoyed the...
Oh, I enjoyed it immensely. I suppose perhaps I should have... If the drunk cast really was just for me, I should probably apologize to everyone else that heard it. I did actually enjoy it.
As long as
vicarious.
We make one person happy, especially you, Greg.
No one can make me happy.
So, what was the... I mean, I know you've seen some of the videos, obviously. Are there any particular that are worth commenting on?
Let's see. Well, yeah, I mean, they're fairly brief. I did enjoy the Vector Graphics one, probably, when Johnny was playing Frogger, or the homebrew faux Frogger.
I like that one too.
But there's still quite a few to come, as I understand. I'm looking forward to the NHL 94 one.
Yeah, that's up on YouTube, actually, if you want to look at it. I just haven't written
that
in a blog
yet. Amazing. It's, like I said, it's got a great ending.
It's great. I mean, if you want to hear me talk classic trash, I mean, probably not at my best, but definitely, like, NHL hockey is kind of, like, right in my wheelhouse, like, that particular game. So, I mean, I was just chattering.
Like, I played a lot of hockey in that time frame, and I didn't really watch a whole lot, and I was just stunned at how much those two remembered about players.
Oh, like, well, I mean, I put so many hours into that game, I know all the rosters.
John's like,
on
you
all
know, at that
teams.
Time, he was driving a 92 DeSoto. Gray. His license plates were like XJR2421. I think that was his second wife. It was like, John, you know way the hell too much about guys who were in the league for like 2 years.
Yeah, I kind of wandered over there and saw them playing the NHL game, and I was like, oh, this is on Genesis, okay. And then I heard them talking about it, and I was like, I'm not even qualified to witness this shit. So I walked away and did something else. So I generally felt that the last day of PAX was a little quieter than the rest of them.
Oh, yeah, it was emptier, too. I mean,
there are two things I want to mention, because, again, the drunk cast was the night before the last day of PAX. We haven't actually talked about any of this stuff on the podcast. So the two things that I am going to remember about Sunday were first going to the Sequelitis panel, which is only the second panel other than our own that I went to. I didn't go to very many. But the Sequelitis panel mainly went because of Jeff Gerstmann. It was the only panel that he was on, and it was one of the last panels of the entire show. So I went over there. There was a long line. I could have gotten in the back of the line and still made it in, I think. But I didn't want to sit in line for an hour and wait for that. So this was the only time of the show where I felt like I should use my badge and see if I can like get special treatment.
Dick move time.
Well, generally speaking, at PAX, I would, you know, at E3, whatever. Like I'm that's my job. Like I'm there to work. So if my badge can get me into somewhere I need to be, then I'm gonna do that. I'm not gonna feel regret. At PAX, it's like all these kids are lining up. They want to see the panel just as much as I do. I'm not assigned to write a story about the panel or anything. So I don't really have any justification for getting in early. I just selfishly want to. So we hung out at the front. We knew the enforcer guy who was at the door, stood up there and had, you know, we had our speaker badges on. I was there with Neil and Lauren, actually. And then this guy, Chris Avalone, comes up. He was one of the panelists for the Sequelitis. He's the creative director at Obsidian, who are releasing Alpha Protocol, and they're doing Fallout New Vegas, and they did Fallout 2, I think, and they did KOTOR 2, etc. I've never played any of their games. So I was like, oh, who do you work for? What games did you do? Like, I did, you know, but he's a super nice guy. And we ended up talking. We were killing some time because the previous panel was ongoing. And anyway, you know, I just told him, we're hanging out here because we, you know, we don't want to get in line. We just want to get in the show. He's like, okay, well, I'll bring you in. And Neil and Lauren didn't even have speaker badges. They had media badges, but
right.
he just walked us in with him. And so we ended up going in there early. We were the first people in there for the audience. So we sat in the front row, like, 3 feet in front of the podium where all the panel's members were sitting. Anyway, the panel was really interesting. They talked about the nature of video game sequels and, you know, why sometimes they're better than the previous game, sometimes they're the worst. What are the dangers of doing a sequel, especially if you're making a sequel to a game that was made by another company, which Ken Levine was there. He made System Shock 2. And he did not, that was his first game. He didn't work on System Shock 1. And then the Obsidian with Chris Avellone, they've done the same thing where they made KOTOR 2 and Fallout 2, etc. So I can see how that would be a pretty dicey proposition, you know, as a developer to get handed that kind of a project. So there were a lot of interesting things. They didn't talk about that many Nintendo games, as you might imagine. And so when they opened up the Q&A, I went back and got in the line for it, which was funny because the Q&A started behind, like, this Q&A kind of started in the middle aisle, like 3 or 4 rows back. So I actually had to get out of my seat and walk backwards to get to the back of the line.
Nice.
But I was the third or fourth person in line. So I got up there and I asked the panel about Red Steel 2. I said, you know, the first game wasn't that great. A lot of people bought it and disliked it. And it was released 4 years ago, or 3.5, you know, basically 4 years ago. So if it was up to you, if this was your game, would you call it Red Steel 2? Why or why not? And Ken Levine gave a pretty nice answer. And then basically the only other person who said anything about it was Jeff Gerstmann, who he kind of thought that he would call it Red Steel 2 just because it gives you that shorthand for the game is about swords and guns. Mm. If nothing else, it kind of tells you what kind of game it is, at least. It tells you like the genre, basically. Anyway, I did listen to the Giant Bombcast this week, and Jeff actually mentioned my question. He didn't know my name, but he actually mentioned the Red Steel thing and how that came up, and he talked about it a couple extra minutes. So, booyah!
There you go.
Slutting around.
That's the payoff.
That's the payoff for my story.
While you were there, John and I were on the floor looking for somebody at that point. I think, was it Carl? And John was busy stealing cards from Turbine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think he was up to about $5,000.
I wasn't stealing cards from them. They were handing them out. I was just getting them handed to me repeatedly.
John's putting on the fake mustache and the wig. Guess I haven't gotten any yet. Can I please have some more? So Carl and I went to look for John, and I knew where John would be right away. And at some point, I lost John. I lost Carl because I found John grinding his character he was going to lose at the end of the afternoon.
You just echolocated John by the. You just listened for the MMO sound effects.
Yep. Basically. And,
you just look for the fat guys in black shirts and you found me.
When we found John, we basically overheard the Magic the Gathering booth announce, or the Wizards of the Coast booth announce, everything in our booth is being given away, so hurry here quickly.
Oh, and shit. I'm sorry I missed that.
I looked at John and said, Johnny's going to be so pissed when he hears this.
I was surprised he wasn't part of the nerd peed.
Yeah. No, I was sitting in the panel. But so after the Sequelitis panel was one of the very last ones, like I said. So after that, our PAX was pretty much over, as far as I knew. We went down to the exhibit hall, Neil and Lauren and I think we met up with Jared down there and played Crackdown 2 because the line was short because the thing was almost over and everybody was at Omegathon or in line for it at least. And I figured we couldn't get into that because it already started. So we went down and got in a shorter line for Crackdown 2 and played that, which was interesting. There's not a whole lot to say about it right now. But from there, they literally like shut down the exhibition hall. Like they said, PAX is over, get out. So we walked out of there, and we were just heading back to the entrance to meet up with everybody. And we walked by the entrance to the main theater where the Omegathon was happening. And we look in there, the door's wide open. There's plenty of standing room in there. And it looks like there's still it's still going on. So we duck in there and just, you know, watch what's happening on stage. Turns out the Omegathon had been delayed like an hour, and so we walked in right as the final event started.
Mm-hmm.
So we got there right on time, didn't miss a thing.
Nice.
So the final event of the Omegathon, which is always, there's always like a mystery game at the end. All the other ones they announce ahead of time so the participants can practice for. But for the final event, it's a mystery, and so you just have to depend on your gaming skills generally.
Right.
And what they did was a relay race. So every team member from the Omegathon teams was at a station, and they had a station. So it was an NES relay. So they had five NES games. Was
four.
Four or five NES games lined up. They were all covered, you know, with white sheets, so they, the people didn't know what it was. But they pull the first one off. It's Super Mario Brothers, and they have to get 50 coins.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got two people on both sides. They're both playing the game separately, and they've got some really kind of awful camera work. trying to cover the action up on the big screen so everybody else can see what's going on. But maybe the defining moment of PAX East for me was this thing starting and everybody is like really hushed. I mean, it's exciting. You know, this is like, this is a big event. There's 10 or 15, 20,000 people in this room watching these guys play Super Mario Brothers, which is like a wizard moment, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So
it is a wizard moment that happened in the movie.
Yeah, it is. It is basically the end of the wizard, right? And these guys are playing through 1-1 of Super Mario Brothers, trying to get as many coins as they can, and they're both pretty even. But when they get to 1-2, one of the guys just it became obvious pretty quickly that either he was bad at Mario or he was so nervous that he pretty much couldn't play it.
He just shit the bed completely.
He did.
Literally.
It was pretty painful to watch. It was like watching someone play Mario for the first time.
The joke.
Yeah, you felt bad for the guy, honestly.
But the guy who was doing well, he got to that 10 coin block. The first one in 1-2, you know, it's kind of in between the columns of
right.
bricks. So when he started hitting that 10 coin block, the crowd went fucking apeshit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I couldn't believe it. It was just an eruption of cheers and applause.
Well, the whole thing is the whole crowd knows how to play that game intimately well.
Exactly, exactly. And so he hits that block, and he's getting near 50 coins, and everybody knows, oh my God, he's about to do it. And it was so electric. And I just thought, this is amazing, because this is like the kind of reaction you would get at an Olympic event or
yep.
something. And yet we're sitting here watching a guy play Super Mario Brothers. It was really special. It really was. That was an amazing moment. And I don't know where you could possibly get that kind of an experience outside of PAX, where you see that many people totally freak out over a guy hitting a coin block.
Yeah, the four games were Mario, Rad Racer. They had to get, I think, 1,500 points. And then on Tetris, they had to clear 10 lines. And then on Contra, they had to beat the first boss. So they had to go actually inside into the 3D area and beat that first boss. And that was epic, too, because they restarted it, I think, twice.
They only restarted it once. But the first time the team that was ahead got to Contra, the game froze.
Yeah,
oh,
and they were creaming the other team,
too.
You've
got eight NESs up there. There's so many things that can go wrong among eight NESs.
Yeah, and that's what kind of tainted the whole thing for me is the first run through, like I guess you had like Team A and Team B, and Team A was just absolutely destroying them.
Way ahead.
And then they had to restart it, and then Team B won. So it was kind of cheap because, you know, like if all things being equal, Team A should have won it.
Yeah, but Team A should have been able to reproduce their performance
That's
at the
true.
Same time. I mean, there's not that much randomness in any of those games except for Tetris.
Yeah, and it was funny because I thought the first time through, I was like, somebody is really going to like get killed on Tetris. And that didn't happen until the second time through. Then the Team A guy shit the bed at Tetris. And it was brutal to watch. It was
and Tetris
painful.
Is the one where I can imagine having that many people watch you play Tetris would be pretty nerve-wracking.
Yeah,
whereas
yeah.
I think with Mario, I would probably just settle into instinct pretty fast. But Tetris, ugh.
Yeah, the final showdown on Contra was epic, though, because
that was really good. They were so close, and they both got to the boss before it ended. So they were both like within 5 seconds of winning.
Yeah, Team B was at the boss, but they weren't really doing too well. And you could just see Team A was doing really well on Contra and like just clearing it out. And you know that they were going to catch up if Team B kept kind of sucking. And then eventually at the end, they were both fighting the boss, but Team B was just a little bit ahead. It was so good.
I think Rad Racer was a poor choice. The
yeah,
other three
I
thought were great. Rad Racer's not, you know, getting 1,500 points is basically just like don't crash. Like there's not that much skill to it.
Yeah.
If they're gonna do Rad Racer, they should have made him use the power glove. Just saying.
That would have been awesome.
Like otherwise,
just to introduce an extra strand of technical unreliability.
No doubt.
I think was it at the last regular packs they had the Famicom Disk System Excitebike Versus, which I mean the FDS is absolutely infamously unreliable.
Oh yeah,
right.
So I can only imagine that's some
and
fun
trying
to get
I
that
have
to work.
To insert some context here. Power Glove is entirely reliable. You can rely on the fact it's not going to do whatever the fuck you want it to do.
Right. I've used a Power Glove, and I thought it, even as a kid, I was like, this is a piece of shit. That movie lied to me. I actually wish there'd been like a Power Glove room at PAX.
Oh, because the Steel Battalion room wasn't.
Yeah, that would have been a nice companion. Maybe next time.
With a huge screen on it, that would have been really cool.
Just watching someone try to play Super Mario Brothers with a Power Glove is hilarious.
Yeah.
Oh,
I think Mike Tyson actually fighting Tyson at the end of the, like, the original Punch Out.
We saw somebody try to fight Mike Tyson without it. It's impossible, so I don't think we need to see somebody do it with the Power Glove.
Yeah, they were having a competition to, like, the first five people to beat Mike Tyson in the retro room got some kind of prize or something.
Mm-hmm.
But I really doubt they found five people who could do it.
No, that's what PAX was for me, though, was that retro room.
Yeah.
It was awesome.
Because, I mean, honestly, I was kind of disappointed by the small number of people who turned up in the retro room.
I thought it was awesome that no one came there.
I know, you know? I know. But they had these competitions throughout the 3 days, and we mentioned one was Tyson. But the one that John and I watched for a little bit was you had to beat, what was it, the first whole level of Silver Surfer?
Yeah,
for the
Silver
NES,
Surfer, which is
which
really
is,
hard.
Which is a historically difficult game.
Yeah. I've beaten that entire game, at least on easy.
Without continuing, though, was the tricky part. Mm. And, like, everything in that game kills you. Like, even the blue air versus the dark blue air, yeah, you die. And
maybe I put in a code for Silver Surfer, actually. I think I probably did do a code.
There was this girl who kept trying to beat it, and she would get to the second stage of the first level, and she'd go down constantly. And she was just getting mad. And she finally beat it, and everybody in that part of the room was just like, yeah!
The whole room stopped and clapped.
Because
everybody knew that it was so difficult.
And like she just looked relieved. It was like that. The look on her face and the reaction of everybody in the room was what PAX is to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was like these people found something completely nerdy. Like the knowledge. I mean, Silver Surfer is a pretty niche comic book character to begin with. And it's like the comic book perception of what a cool person would be like. Oh, he surfs. He's awesome.
You're getting really heady here now.
A notoriously difficult NES game about a niche comic book character that is a comic book reader's perception of a cool person. I mean, how fucking niche is that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then throw the fact that it's a gaming challenge on top of it. That's about, like, the definition of what nerdiness is to me.
Yeah.
It was just kind of like the ultimate manifestation of whatever nerdy fantasy you've ever wanted to indulge but didn't want to do it because it's just too embarrassing.
Yeah. What I thought was so cool was that you got exposed to other aspects of nerdery that you wouldn't otherwise be exposed to, like Magic the Gathering or tabletop games.
It does seem a little strange to me to travel. Maybe a lot of them were from Boston or nearby, but it seems strange to me that you would jump on a plane and fly across the country to play a board game with someone. Like, I'm not sure that I would recommend PAX to people who are just kind of casually interested and aren't really sure what they would do when they get there. I mean, if you've been before, you'll know, but if you haven't been before, it's really hard to recommend that people go to it because it's certainly not like E3 where all this interesting stuff is being kind of, you know, forced onto you, like it's being pushed at you because these companies are trying to sell their games or trying to promote their games.
Yeah,
so,
and there's more mass media stuff too, like famous people signing autographs and stuff like that.
There is, but E3 is a lot of, you know, you go there to consume what is at E3,
mm-hmm.
whereas PAX is like you bring your shit with you to do there.
And that was, I think that was the mistake that some of us made, because I know I'm not the only one who was going in there ready to indulge themselves in E3 style journalism. But
sure,
the reality of the situation was there wasn't anything to do there. Many of the games there were already out, and they were just trying to sell them to the people who were there.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
If you were on the show floor, for example, which I didn't even call it the show floor, but I mean, that's kind of what it was referred to as colloquially, is that anything worth really experiencing there had massive lines that was are almost impenetrable.
Yeah.
So you just sort of walked past him like, yep, there's APB. That's got a long-ass line.
In general, I think the lines were really out of control at PAX.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the venue's fault or just the way the whole thing's set up. I think part of it is that people go there and maybe they do get bored. Maybe they're not interested in sitting around playing tabletop games or whatever for hours and hours. So instead they go to the one aspect of the game of the entire convention that is like E3 in that it's sort of presented for you to consume, which is like the panels.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so the panels get these outrageous lines.
Yeah. I mean, every panel had like a line that was probably an hour and a half or 2 hours long.
but the reason ours didn't is because the keynote had tens of thousands of people trying to get into it.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. I mean, for only an hour-long panel, waiting in line for 2 hours is really, really silly.
It is moronic.
It is.
What I wonder is if they had picked a better venue, they have done...
Well, they're trading up next year already.
Do you know where?
They've got the Boston Convention Center next
year.
Oh,
wow, that's going to be a huge upgrade.
Already sewn up, man.
Because, I mean, this place is attached to a freaking mall.
So I feel like we've overdone PAX, so I really want to move on and do one or two emails here. Starting with, the elephant in the room we haven't really talked about yet, so... Greg, this is your email.
Yeah, so Chris O'Brien sent this particular message in, but you also got emails on this topic from Dave Mellett and Marty from Belfast. But Chris writes, first off, you're my heroes. I love your show. Enough said.
I'm sorry.
Secondly, I was wondering, what are your thoughts on the recently announced Nintendo 3DS? What do you see in its potential? What would be any cool games you would like to see? Thanks a lot for having an awesome podcast.
This is my substitute for doing like a feature on 3DS, because we don't know that much about it right now. We can certainly talk out of our asses for hours.
It's funny because we had settled on what our topic was going to be for the panel, and this got announced, and I sent an email to John basically saying, shit, dude, how long before we get a question on this?
Yeah.
And it was, what, like the second question?
Yeah. I don't know. The 3DS, I mean, we talked about it a little on the panel. I do think we didn't really talk that much about the 3D effect or what that means. And there was a really interesting segment on Four Guys Went Up where Jeremy Parrish was talking to Chris Kohler. And they went into some pretty good depth on the 3D technology and what it might mean. I think what they didn't touch on much is game design. And I'm really curious... I'm having a hard time imagining a kind of game or an aspect of gameplay that could not be done before, but now will be enabled by 3D.
No, none. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's not what it's about, I think. I mean, well, I know that's not what it's about. This is a multi-part strategy. So, first off, I think Nintendo is sufficiently spooked by the iPod Touch. I think that is manifest here, and this is something it cannot do, and this is a gimmick they can sell. And I think they looked at what was on the market. They could do cheaply because that is their way.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously they started working on this before this year. But they probably saw this coming down the pipe because we've all known 3D movies were on the way for about 4 years now. So they probably said, you know, if that Avatar movie's big, there's going to be a lot of this.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you just think they're like headhunting technology.
It's a way to extend the DS brand as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I mean,
without completely going back to the drawing board. You know,
right.
they can keep that DS brand and, you know, tweak it in such a way so that people will think it's something absolutely new.
But and Johnny's exactly right. They headhunted for technology that could differentiate them from what they regard as their only serious competitor. Mm-hmm. And that ain't Sony.
No.
Well, I mean, and, you know, the PSP2 could very well, in fact, probably will be announced this year. So there's really not that much to keep Sony from making their new system 3D as well.
Yeah, they kind of made some comments about them not thinking it was a terribly good idea. So I don't
but, know but you know, they said the same thing about the Wii Remote. So
just anything Sony does, just do the opposite and you'll be fine.
Sony PR is...
All right, can we make a storage device? It's really expensive.
Yeah, obviously, with the timing of the announcement and everything is quite intriguing. I certainly think, you know, Johnny was right in the panel there. It was related to the fiscal year issues.
Well, it was because they thought that it was leaked to journalists.
Yeah, you know, there was information out there in Japan which was probably related to the fact that their suppliers had to reveal things related to their fiscal situation, probably, which ended up cutting off the DSi XL in America. But I don't think that's a particularly big deal, because you've got to think of, there's some people that it might affect that are thinking about upgrading a DS, but I think most people that they're looking at with the XL probably are, you know, the sort of the more expanded audience kind of thing. And,
or the people who want the DSi XL because it's gigantic, not because
that are just enamored with the sort of very specific nature of it.
Yeah, most of the people, like, if you read on our forums, you'll see some people say, well, I guess I'm not getting an XL now. And that's fine. But those people are generally the people who just kind of want the newest thing from Nintendo. I mean, if you want the XL for the specific qualities that it brings to the table, then, you know, the 3DS, I'm sure, will not be as big. So if you want really huge screens, then the XL is still a good choice.
Presumably, NCL probably would have avoided it if they could, but they felt they couldn't, given whatever particular circumstances.
Their hand was forced. And all you have to look at is that announcement was posted on the investor relations portion of their website.
Exactly.
With no announcement sent to any of us, basically.
Well, yeah, I mean, it wasn't actually a press release. It was like a memo to their investors in Japan. I'm surprised they even bothered putting it in English, because they don't have any, you know, English-speaking investors, ostensibly.
But I do feel, especially to the kind of investor market, you know, something as simple as 3DS, I think is important. That will resonate, you know. The people looking at the trends right now are going to see that and think, oh, you know, that's going to be a very significant product development.
It's a good name.
But in terms of what they've got for E3, I do feel like there's going to have to be a few more pieces to the puzzle here in terms of the unique features that it has.
Yeah.
Because, as you say, in terms of game design and things like that, the questions about how much it's really going to give you are unanswered.
You can go back to the template for Virtual Boy games. You know, I think back to, like, Wario Land for Virtual Boy, which is a great game. Certainly the game worth owning on Virtual Boy.
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. Love it.
And the idea there was that you had basically two planes, and Wario could jump from the foreground to the background, and it was like, kind of like playing two levels at the same time, and you would jump back and forth between them, and which they've now done with Super Paper Mario, does some of that stuff. Mm-hmm. You don't really need 3D display to do that kind of a game. It just looks cool. I mean, it makes more sense when you've got a 3D effect, but also at the same time, when the Virtual Boy was released, Nintendo didn't have the technology to do polygons on a handheld. So for them, it was a way, and this was, you know, like a year before N64, the PlayStation was out, the Saturn was out. So 3D graphics were a new big thing, and the Virtual Boy was a way to give a very convincing 3D effect without needing really, really high-grade graphics processing back then. Whereas now, obviously, the original DS does polygons. The 3DS will certainly do plenty more polygons.
Right.
So the 3D effect, I think, in the age of polygonal graphics, I think the design space for parallax 3D is kind of redundant. Like, you don't need parallax to do 3D games, whereas in the Virtual Boy, it only made sense. I mean, you can't really do a good 3D effect on the Game Boy screen. So the Virtual Boy was a way to bring
a sense of depth using 2D elements, essentially.
But at the same time, on the N64, you get even a much better sense of depth from using polygons and a camera.
Well, right. And the difference here, at least as far as what I've been able to discern from looking at technology that's already out there in Japan, we've been hearing estimates of its capability as near GameCube. I'm kind of questioning that myself personally.
I think that's reasonable.
What, that is near GameCube power?
Yes. The PSP is near GameCube power.
Yes, but so is the Wii, and that's my concern.
Well, regardless, it's been 4 years since either of those systems was launched.
I recognize that, but I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't want to make it that powerful, for cost reasons.
Or battery.
I could buy that.
If that is a cost factor at this point, I mean, that's what it really come down to.
Well,
cost.
I mean, and anytime you make something small, it's a cost factor. But they can do 3D already, so not true 3D, but just visual 3D in the game, and then compare that, or then layer parallax on top of that, you can get a much better perception of depth than you could get with either of those things separately. And I think that if they're going to go with that, obviously games like Star Fox would be no-brainers.
I was thinking about Xscape, which is a DSiWare game in itself, but, you know, and it kind of reminds me of Red Alarm or whatever it was.
Yes, mm-hmm. Red Alarm.
That was on Virtual Boy. It's a DSiWare game, so presumably it wouldn't be like forward compatible or anything in the future, or maybe they could do an update to it or a sequel. But that kind of stylized aspect, I think, would actually work quite well with a 3D effect.
I think a 3D Mario title would be, depending on how the controls are, would be really interesting.
I don't know. I mean, to me, when you've already got polygonal graphics with that sense of depth that you can get from, you know, from being able to pull the camera out like that and move it around a character, when you've already got that level of fidelity, which was in a launch title for the Nintendo DS, you know, with Mario 64 DS.
Right.
When you've already got that, to me, putting a parallax effect on it doesn't enhance the illusion that much.
I don't know. It's difficult because I haven't really seen what this sort of stereoscopic 3D can do for polygonal games. I mean, that's going to be a lot of it, really. I think, you know, sort of seeing is believing with this sort of thing. There's going to be a lot of what we see at E3, just how impressive it is. Obviously, it's the natural thing to assume, and it's terribly sensible, that Nintendo has got, you know, very, very proven sort of older technology that's been around for a while, and the sharp parallax barrier stuff has been around for a while.
Yeah.
But there is still the question of, you know, we always hear about how much money they were spending on R&D, and you wonder whether this is going to, you know, whether there'll be any element of this hardware that will raise our eyebrows and wonder whether that was the source of the extra expenditure. And it may well not be the 3D part.
It may be the graphics processor.
Well, was it NVIDIA about a year ago, said in one of their financial releases that something along the lines, that we're making the processor for the next Nintendo handheld.
Yeah, and it's the Tegra processor.
The most recent things I've heard sort of all go in the other direction, that it would just be a, you know, miniaturized GameCube that ATI have kind of worked on for a little while, if you're lowering the power consumption and all that sort of stuff. So,
yeah.
I mean, but I feel strongly that there has to be, I think this whole 3D element is a good gateway.
But there's more to it. Well, I'll tell you my theory. I wrote about this on the forums several weeks ago when we were talking about the next DS and what it would have. And no one guessed 3D, I don't think, but...
I actually retroactively guessed it by editing an old post, but...
Oh, gosh.
Jesus.
Congratulations, you win the internet. So, my thesis that I laid out back then is that the next DS is going to have a built-in accelerometer, which Iwata has hinted at strongly, but
I don't think
it's so much for motion control of DS games, because... What you've seen is that motion control doesn't work that well on a handheld screen because you're moving the screen at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, a lot of iPhone games try to do this and fail because there's some serious problems with it. And the original Kirby's Tilt and Tumble on Game Boy Color was hard to play because you're moving the screen all over the place.
Mm-hmm. It would have been hard to see
the screen.
And the
field of vision was really bad on that screen. Right. So I think, you know, and I'm sure the option will be there for motion control of 3DS games if it has an accelerometer.
I mean, how well do you think? I mean, I guess this again, you have to see it in action, but you wonder how well that would go with the 3D element.
It would be terrible.
Yeah, it might be one or the other.
Certainly, the notion with this parallax barrier technology is that it's well suited to a handheld because you would be, you know, in one specific spot,
right,
and that's where
yeah.
the illusion works. But if you're jostling it around to control it, then
There is, not to get too technical here, there is a version of parallax screens that allow you to have multiple points of sit, so multiple angles of viewing, where mm-hmm. you still get the effect. It's more expensive, though, and that's...
Yeah. And they're also like discrete points. It's not,
not
everywhere.
Yeah, continuous.
Right, but I mean, it's not like you have to sit 12 inches from the screen dead on.
To finish my point, though, I think what the accelerometer will primarily be used for is exercise games, or more to the point, like some kind of exercise app that will probably be built into the system, if not like included as a launch title or a pack-in or something.
What, like for jogging with or something like that?
It's basically DS Fit.
Yes.
Because they've experimented with this with like personal trainer walking and now the Poke Walker, but I think building it into the system is really key for Nintendo's strategy. If you think about everything they've done with Wii Fit and all this other stuff, so I think you can ignite a huge new wave of DS players, older gamers, women, etc., by making the 3DS something that fits in your pocket and measures your steps, whether it's on or off. You don't need any special software. You don't have to plug any doohickey into it. It just does it. If you carry it around, even if you're playing a game, if you're carrying this thing around and bouncing up and down, it measures your steps. And
that's hot.
It could potentially even be used for, yes, like a jogging simulator. You could even maybe, it could come with like an arm strap where you put it on your arm and do exercises like EA Sports Active style. It's very easy to do.
It'll have to have a pretty small form factor for that, though. The DS is much too big for that.
The DSi XL is way too big for that.
It'll have to be like iPhone size.
The MyTouch. It's a phone. It's I can't remember who carries it, but it actually has an app that you strap it to your arm and it measures things like sit-ups and jogging and stuff. And they
yes.
advertise it very heavily.
I think that will be an integral part of the 3DS.
That could be very reasonable.
That is so Nintendo right now. It's easy to do. It's very easy to explain to people. They can even release a new Wii Fit that will interact with the 3DS import data back and forth. This is like exercise crack.
This
okay?
is their conversion shit going on. I mean,
yeah, I can just see this being like a cultural phenomenon with people carrying their DSs around and being more active, and you know, and it's totally unrelated to the 3D effect. There's,
yeah,
you know.
I really think there's been a number of things that are unrelated to the 3D. I still think, as like I mentioned in the prediction show back at the beginning of the year, that we might well see a handheld virtual console at some point with this new device.
That would be a total dick move if they waited till another handheld
I mean, first of all, if it is substantially more powerful, I'm sure that will help with the emulation.
Oh, yeah, no question.
And as we know, you know, with this parallax barrier technology, you know, as it applies to backwards compatible games and all that, you know, that you could just turn it, it could effectively just function exactly like a normal 2D screen. So.
Yeah.
You know, you'll be able to play all your old DS games and possibly these virtual handheld games without any difficulties there. So, I mean, I still think they may well, you know, go full court press in terms of, okay, we're going to have virtual console for the sort of traditional Nintendo handheld players. Then we've got the fitness thing that you're talking about to go for the expanded audience guys. You've got the 3D that's going to kind of get everyone to want to see it, you know, in store.
Oh, and it makes it hard as hell to pirate, too.
Yeah. Maybe.
So, I mean, I think that's probably what you look at, very multi-pronged sort of thing. And I guess the real question is going to be what sort of exclusives, first-party games and third-party exclusives, are we going to see launch with the system? Because obviously, you know, I mean, this is in some ways as an announcement, as a lead-in, similar to the DS, because when the DS was first spoken about, we didn't see anything of it at all. I remember seeing a bunch of amusing mock-ups of the DS before we actually saw
it. All we knew was it had two screens.
Yeah, folding shit with speakers coming off. It was crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we didn't even know about the touch.
They didn't know about the touchscreen, which is a massive element, you know, there was so much we didn't know, and this is pretty similar. But of course, the DS was so much quicker on the heels of the GBA.
Right.
You know, we were talking about the DS in the early part of 2004, when the GBA was only, you know, 2.5 years old. You know, so this is very different. You would think that perhaps this time they've got their ducks in a row for a much more significant opening salvo.
Well, I always felt like the DS was kind of a stopgap device. I mean, there was the third pillar element, which was obviously a stopgap mechanism, that they could have bailed on it. And I wonder if this is maybe what, if they had had a few more years, the DS might have been. Like, if they could have
But they never had to make that jump.
Right, because they never felt there was a need to make it.
DS itself is still selling remarkably well in America, mm-hmm. in particular.
Yeah.
They really aren't under much pressure to release the 3DS even now.
The only thing
I
come up with now is that they've decided that within, you know, maybe a year or two in America, they'll lose that momentum too.
No, I mean, if you get complacency will hurt you.
They apparently didn't mind being complacent on the Game Boy, though.
Well, Nintendo and Sony have both fallen foul of complacency to some extent, and some of the hardware decisions they've made, more in the console markets, obviously. But I think it's good for them to sort of try and stay on the heels of the market, as it were.
I think it makes sense to continue selling and marketing the DS after the 3DS comes out, because now what you've got is, so the problem with the GBA was already so cheap that it did feel weird having the DS on the market at the same time. What they can do now is that as DS sales start to slow down, they still have a lot of room. They can do price cuts on those systems.
Absolutely.
With the DSi and XL, they have tons of room for price cuts. So what this allows them to do is reduce those prices to keep sales strong, even though it'll cut their profits. And now they can introduce the 3DS, which will be the premium, the more expensive handheld that they can kind of start over again. So it's not like the DS will disappear right off the bat. I mean, if you remember, GBA sold pretty well for quite a while after DS was introduced.
Even when they tried to kill it, and they're just like, we're not making games. Please stop buying.
I think that will be different this time. I mean, last time, especially in America, it seemed like they were sort of quite resolute about not putting anything out, even to the Bit Generations or Mother 3.
Yeah.
Or any. It was a number of games that continue to come out in Japan, Rhythm Heaven being another good example.
That's perfect. They almost seemed annoyed that the DS...
I think it seemed like NOA had a strategy, a clean break strategy. I don't think we'll see that employed anywhere anytime soon as it applies to the DS and the 3DS.
Yeah, it's too strong. I mean, there's no way they would want to separate themselves from it. They'd want to embrace it. Like, hey, this is another DS. You know the other DS you liked?
We know the 3DS is 100% backwards compatible with the DS, but the difference between that and obviously it was with the GBA, but they had created a new brand with the DS, whereas this, they're extending an existing brand.
Yeah, yeah, we're building off of this already very successful.
My only concern with the different concepts we've thrown out here is that we know Nintendo likes to have convergence of message. Like, they'll do an E3 presser all about basically refit, because they want a single message out there in the public, this is what we do. And I'm worried if they're going to go all these different ways, it's kind of maybe they screw themselves up pretty easily sometimes. Maybe they overcomplicate things for themselves. But I could see them very easily being able to say, this is the DS lineup. They can keep that branding going because it's still the DS lineup. It's just
they've
the
already got
DS.
The DS family of handheld systems.
Yeah, that could just simmer away in the background without too much, you know, and they've got their evergreen titles that will continue to sell that hardware. They don't really need to bring out new DS games to sell the hardware, whereas they will obviously be under much more pressure to bring out the killer apps for the 3DS to sell people on it as it being a worthy sort of platform. And I would anticipate that it'll do so actually very much better in the end of this year or the beginning of next than the DS did at the end of 2004 and the beginning of 2005.
See, I do think that they've spoken about this earlier. I think the fact that we have a consistent brand is so massive for them because they've built up this image of the I hate to use this phrase, I know John hates it when people use it, the blue ocean image.
Love it.
That they can continue to market anything that bears the DS moniker alongside of it.
Disruptive innovation.
It's so, I mean, I know I'm getting into pack attack territory here, but...
The pack attack.
You're going into the eye of the maelstrom, so to speak.
No, oh, good lord. One of the most interesting things, and this came up very much in the discussion of Four Guys, what up with Parrish and Cola, how integral is the 3D element or not? And, you know, like how much they want to play it up, because... As we said, the screens will be such that you could kind of switch off the 3D effect. And it would certainly do that automatically for old games. But how much will you have new games that it's like, do you just want to play it with the effect on or off? You know, would the system be named after 3D when this feature is apparently so frivolous? And as we said, on game design terms, it seems actually quite difficult to make it integral to the gameplay and stuff. So it may be interesting to see what efforts they make to try and convince people that it's pivotal when it perhaps isn't.
Yeah.
Right. That's going to be something that I don't think we're going to know even maybe until the first year. We might know how they're going to approach it, but
the market will dictate to some extent. Well, yeah, it'll probably be a bunch of different approaches one could take, and we'll see what software sells the best. But in terms of E3, I feel that there's going to be a lot more that they've got to kind of rip the lid off, if you like. What they decide to play up is going to be really interesting, you know, especially considering who are they even talking to at E3 these days? You know, are they going to be talking to the games press that's actually there, or are they going to be talking above their heads to the more mainstream media?
It does tend to almost vary, not even by the year, but by the minute who they talk to in some of these events.
I think last year they did a good job of, you know, Shakespearing it, where, you know, stuff for the people in the crowd and people up in the boxes.
It's kind of weird because there really was stuff like, this is for you, this is for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, you could feel it transition.
That it does still surprise me that they use E3 as a platform for launching things like Wii Fit.
Yeah.
Because it seems like Nintendo could probably even like host their own event that would make the whole thing a lot less muddled.
Have like Jack LaLanne there as the host.
Because E3 is primarily enthusiast press. And so, you know, they're really kind of putting themselves out there in a very vulnerable way, and they've gotten shit for it, too.
And then at PAX East, they show off, like, Pokemon.
Which everybody in PAX East already owned, except for myself.
Yeah, it
and
just seems really weird. Like, it's just, I don't know what they do at these shows sometimes.
Well, okay, we've stopped talking about 3DS. We will certainly return to this topic many, many, many times. So, I think we should probably end the show there. I know it was only one email, but it was a big one. So next time we will catch up on your listener mail. We'll have several. And before we go, I do want to express my thanks to Carl Castaneda for recording and editing all those podcasts that we got out of PAX. He spent a lot of money and a lot of time working on all that stuff. And he was, as you know, very, very expedient about getting those shows up. So I know a lot of our listeners have expressed their appreciation for it, and I wanted to do the same. One last thing, our next retroactive poll will be up by the time you hear this, and we're going to be showcasing Game Boy and Game Boy Color games. Decided to keep GBA separate, so that will be another poll someday. I don't know when. But for now, we're going to do Game Boy and Game Boy Color games, and the lineup is not 100% finalized now, so I won't say it just to protect myself from being wrong. But we've got it down to like the last four or five games, so we're just trying to finalize it now. But that will be up by the time you listen to this. There will be definitely some very interesting games on there. I hope some things that you've always wanted to play but never got around to. I'm going for that. I'm hoping that we'll actually get into something new this time and experience it. And of course, since there is not a virtual handheld currently, you may have to, and we may have to, actually track down cartridges on some of this stuff. So keep that in mind. I am trying to choose nominees that are pretty affordable and pretty available. So you will not see Ninja 5-0 on there.
Damn.
Or Faceball 2000.
Damn.
Oh.
I mean, some of these games I would love to play. They're either impossible to find or they cost $150. So.
That's right. Faceball 2000, forum MVP for Game Boy games.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, look for that. Plan to vote, and we'll announce the winner soon. Of course, always check out the NWR newscast, where they will be very soon talking about Cave Story, in addition to Pokemon and PAX and all that stuff. And the Radio Trivia Podcast Edition, I believe the newest episode has Greg Leahy.
That's right. I make my Radio Trivia return after more than a year, like a comet. I flash across the soundscape of Radio
That's
Trivia.
That's right. If John gets on there next, I think we'll have done the sweep of the...
Yeah, to be fair, it's been longer since John's been on it, actually.
That's a lot of pressure, guys.
That's a lot of pressure on TYP, not you, John.
I just suck at recognizing video game music, that's all.
That's fine.
TYP always records Radio Trivia on weekends, which is why when I'm always editing this podcast. So it's been pretty much just I love Radio Trivia. I enjoyed all the previous occasions I've been on it. But it's just logistically impossible until last week for me to do it. And so I took full advantage, and there's a lot of, they're all my choices, actually. So there's not terribly much mystery about it. But TYP indulged me, and hopefully you enjoy the games that I chose.
So I'll just guess Sin and Punishment for all five until I get it right.
Two.
I don't wish to spoil the show, but you would be entirely incorrect.
All right. Well, James did a great job a couple weeks ago when he was on it. I cannot wait to hear your approach to it. So with that said, we're going to skip out of here. We'll be back next week with lots more crazy discussion of all things Nintendo and a bunch of other shit too. So thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Peace.
See ya.
Well, the thing is, with that game, it's all about the team you pick. So, I mean, the teams, there are certain teams that just have players that are absolutely stacked, like the Blackhawks, you know.
Yeah, and John told me to pick like, he's like, go ahead and pick, you want me to pick Atlanta or Chicago? And I'm like, fuck you, I'm going Ottawa.
Yeah, see, it's not really about, the thing is you can't go by the rankings of the teams, like numerically, because some teams have certain players that you cannot check. Or some players, if you hit them with a one-timer, they will score every fucking time, no matter what.
Welcome to the NHL 94 Genesis version tips and tricks strategy.
It is. That's the way that game is. So if you don't know that, you probably will get rolled.
Did you put the whole video up there on YouTube, or like an edited version?
Oh, no, it's the whole thing. It's all three periods.
Oh, Jesus Christ. It's like 15 and a half minutes of just them playing hockey and me going, ah, into the camera, Blair Witch style.
You have to watch the whole game to really appreciate it, because
the end.
There's many highs and lows in that game. You have to really appreciate what I did there, James. You have to see the whole video.
Because John was getting rolled. So
yes.
Yeah, he was getting beaten like a rented mule.
Yeah, I came back to ultimate victory and better, actually more importantly, justice. Justice was served that day, James.
It's cold, like revenge.
It's cold like the ice.
Like the ice I skate on. What?
Like there was between the halls, there was the vendor area, which was kind of upsettingly small. I was hoping it would be really big and elaborate, and I could spend all my hard-earned money on shit I'll never need. But there was a table there, and I made a joke about this at one point. That was, what was it, $800? It was a Magic the Gathering playing table.
Yeah, I mean, they had some. These were massive tables about
it's
the size
like
a
of a super premium poker table.
Completely people... wood, and like I think there was one there for, was it for Risk or something?
Yes.
Yeah, and so it had it had two wooden panels on the top of it. On the top surface of the table was two wooden panels that you removed, that you lifted them out and off, and inlaid was an entire Risk board. Huge, yes. Risk board. And it's just looking at it, it's like
permanent,
wow.
A permanent Risk board?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, with glass over it. And it's just like, wow, like that is the coolest thing I've ever seen. Like somebody actually...
But it could also be useful if you're a James Bond villain.
Yeah.
Yes. Definitely. Definitely.
Like if you come into someone's house and they have an $800 table that turns into a Risk board, you need to leave.
Manabima!